One way we lead in life is by helping others develop faith and testimony. In a world where it seems more and more individuals are questioning their faith, Leading Saints has put together the Questioning Saints Virtual Summit, an online resource that many have found extremely helpful. Just text the word LEAD to 474747, and we'll send you more information about the Questioning Saints Virtual Summit. Hey everyone, this is Kurt Frangum with Leading Saints, and you have clicked on the play button ever so gently to experience another episode of the Leading Saints podcast, and I'll be your host. Now, if you're new to Leading Saints, I welcome you. I hope a friend, family member, an individual that you love in your life has sent you to this resource, and I hope you explore the various content we have all around the concept of leadership in the context of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Our goal here is to help Latter-day Saints be better prepared to lead in all aspects of life, home, church, professional life, wherever else you find yourself, you can be an awesome leader. Now, I want to remind everybody, there's only a few weeks left for the Leading Saints Church Tour. It's happening in September, the last week in September. If you are interested in getting on a nice tour bus with the Leading Saints community, including myself, and visiting all the major history sites between Kansas City, Missouri, and Sharon, Vermont, well, we'd love to have you. It's going to be such an experience, and I'd love to meet so many of you there and interact with you over those 11 days. All flights and travel and about 50% of the meals are covered in the price of the tour. And to see the full itinerary and to grab one of the handful of seats left, visit leadingsaints.org/tour. And again, register soon before all remaining seats on the bus are filled up. Now, in this episode, we talk with Jim Quigley. He is originally from Kanosh, Utah, a very small town, went to Utah State University. Later spent a career at Deloitte, a professional service company, where he raised the ranks and became the CEO of that huge company of hundreds of thousands of employees. And he's a former bishop in Connecticut. I first learned about Jim Quigley when I read the book, The Mormon Way of Doing Business, which if you haven't read it, definitely an awesome read that profile a handful of different business leaders that happen to be Latter-day Saints and their values and discuss their values, how they connect with their professional life. Really awesome read by Jeff Benedict. This was a fun conversation. I met up with him in Park City, Utah. He was speaking there and we spent a few minutes in a hotel room as I had him speak into a mic. We talk about building culture in an organization, especially a large organization, learning from mentors, finding balance between your busy professional life and a busy religious life, and so much more. So here is my interview with Jim Quigley. Today, I find myself in Park City, Utah, sitting in a hotel with Jim Quigley. How are you?
All good. Thank you.
Good. Is it all right if I call you Jim? Is
that? Of course.
All right. Great. Now, I first became familiar with your name and your background years ago when I read the book, The Mormon Way of Doing Business, and it talked about you, your time as the CEO of Deloitte. What on earth is Deloitte?
Well, Deloitte happens to be the largest professional services firm in the world, and today over 275,000 professionals around the world.
Wow. And so professional services, that includes like HR services or accounting, or what does that entail?
Primarily consulting, advisory services, tax, and audit services.
Hmm. And there's a lot of business. I mean, with a lot of businesses in this world, they look to you.
No question about it.
Yeah. And it's a thriving and growing company that I'm sure you left in a good spot when you left there.
They're doing dramatically better without me than they were with me.
Are you still looking at?
You haven't succeeded until your successors succeed. And
that's
I'm
great.
Very pleased with how the successors are succeeding.
Nice. Now, and you grew up in Utah, in a small town.
Mm-hmm.
Whereabouts exactly?
Kanosh. I was born in Salt Lake City, but my father obtained his district in Kanosh when I was 5 years old. And so all of my education, my primary years through high school, were in Kanosh, mm-hmm. and then off to Utah State.
So pretty traditional Latter-day Saint family?
Yes, my father was a convert. He was, I think, one of the few Baptists in the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, perhaps the only Baptist in the Mormon Tabernacle Choir.
Wow.
But while he was singing in the choir, he did obtain a testimony and was converted.
Wow, really? So I think now it's a calling. So I don't know if they'd allow non-members.
Not sure how many Baptists you'd find in the choir today.
And
but I know in 1947, you found one.
Interesting. I mean, if you join the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, I don't know how else you would not convert. I mean, it's such a powerful, impressionable experience.
You definitely have a love of music.
Yeah.
And the artistic excellence of the choir is something that's just omnipresent. So if you love to sing and were very good at it, mm-hmm. there's not a better place that you would want to be.
Yeah.
It's somewhat like, how does Leonard Bernstein lead the Messiah? What's a good Jewish boy doing leading the Messiah at Lincoln Center?
Yeah.
It's a love of the music.
Yeah, for sure.
And so a Baptist can have a love of that music. And then with that collective experience, might one day decide to join the church, which my father did.
That's fantastic. So did he pass that love of music on to you in some respect?
I do love music, but I don't have the performance ability that he enjoyed.
You're not going to end up in the tabernacle singing anytime soon. But
I don't have any letters inviting me to come try out.
Nice. So how would you describe as a youth your faith development?
Well, I think if you grew up in a small town, and especially in a small town in southern Utah, everyone that you know are members of the church. Mm-hmm. And so your circle is very much a church circle. And so socially, as well as what you do on Sunday, as well as what happens in your home, simply becomes fundamental to the development of that core belief. Mm-hmm. And then participating in family prayer daily for many years, it will have an impact on you.
Yeah. And I know it mentions in the book that you were pretty competitive high school quarterback.
I did enjoy some accomplishment there. I mean, I'm proud of what we were able to do.
And did you feel like that was maybe your first leadership role in your life?
I think so. I think when you really think about the role of the quarterback and the way in which an offense is expected to behave, that's the first time that I, in a palpable way, I was the senior patrol leader mm-hmm. of our scout troop. But I do think that a greater impact and more influence on me were those days on the football field, and those days with a football coach, I think, had more impact on me than did being the senior patrol leader.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fascinating. So, and then you did your undergrad at Utah State, is that right?
That is correct.
And when did the spark of, going into business and being a leader in business start? I mean, did you sort of see yourself as a CEO of a major corporation when you're in college?
Not at all. Not at all. And in fact, my father was a forester. His father was a forester. Mm. And I went to Utah State with the ambition that I would also be a forester.
Wow.
And then as you begin just simply doing the basic undergraduate work, and I understood that of the 100 forestry degrees that Utah State awarded, there were 3 graduates that were able to obtain a job in their field.
Oh, really?
And the other 97 had to find other ways to make their living. And I just pragmatically started thinking, maybe that's not the right field for me.
And did that come before you? Did you get that degree or did you make that decision before?
I made that decision as a freshman.
Oh, okay.
And then I went to the business school.
Nice. And then how would you describe the development of your business career after college? When was that pivot point that sort of led you back east to in these major roles, the executive roles?
Well, I completed my undergraduate degree in accounting, and I was recruited by Deloitte to their Salt Lake City office. And after 4 years working in the Salt Lake City office, I had decided that I was going to leave public accounting and go to work for one of our clients who had offered to double my salary and offered me a company car, and it sounded like a pretty good move. And then the firm was aggressive in their efforts to retain me, and they tried to impress upon my mind that people who can succeed in public accounting should be in public accounting, and that I might not be happy doing anything else. And so 38 years later, I retired from Deloitte, but it was the only job that I had from college.
Yeah. So did you reach upper management here in Utah, and then that sort of sent you back east?
No. The career progression was very much in a combination of St. Louis and New York. Hmm. I left here in 1979 as a senior accountant, and I became a manager in New York and then a partner in St. Louis. And then through my leadership roles, I was fundamentally in New York.
Mm-hmm. I guess I'm looking for your early leadership development. A lot of people, did you find that early on at Deloitte? Is that where it first started?
Well, Deloitte mattered a great deal because you are leading a team by the time you've only been at the firm for 2 years. And you're working aggressively and effectively with clients towards accomplishing sometimes challenging assignments. And so I think very much at Deloitte, it was a school of leadership learning. And then as I stated in that, when I was interviewed by Jeff Benedict in the book you earlier referenced of the Mormon Way of Doing Business, I think I learned a great deal about leadership as a ward clerk and as a ward executive secretary and as a stake executive secretary. And then as a member of a bishopric. And by just simply watching what I believed were some remarkable and some remarkably effective leaders perform their essential role in the ecclesiastical setting. That was an important part of my development as a leader.
Yeah. And that's another thing that sort of stood out to me as I read the different parts about your story in that book is that mentorship played a big role in your development, whether it was intentional mentorship, you know, working one-on-one, but or being in the same room as a lot of these leaders that you really respected.
Yeah, I'm just always curious and I'm always wanting to learn and understand and willing to watch what works and what works less.
Yeah.
And then how you can learn from that.
Yeah. So going back to that time as a ward clerk, what did that look like as far as the application? Were you asking a lot of questions, you know, after the meeting or during the meeting, or how are you?
You're watching leaders lead. Mm-hmm. You're watching a bishop who happens to be an enormously successful business executive. And you're watching his first counselor, who happens to be the CEO of the largest private company in the world, who went on to be, you know, one of the 70, Donald L. Staley.
Oh, wow.
But by watching Rod Haas and Don Staley and Weston Edwards perform their church role, you could learn a great deal.
Yeah.
And I did.
Yeah. Is there any particular principle that comes to mind that you say they had it figured out that you saw unfold and applied to your own leadership?
I think just the whole notion of the one and the ability to view success as connecting and then trying to help and influence the one. And then that frequently scales to the many, but they were very good at, you know, thinking about and then just simply watching and listening to them. I learned a great deal.
You know, when I had opportunity to serve as bishop, that principle of the one, I really enjoyed, you know, the one-on-one interaction with lots of members of the ward. And then when I moved on to serving a stake presidency, I was overcome because I was still trying to have that one-to-one interaction, but there were so many members in the stake, it was hard to have that same relationship. And so I'm curious, in an organization like Deloitte, that you have hundreds of thousands of employees, like how do you still have that one-on-one mentality or the one mentality with that when there's so many ones?
Well, you just simply try to not squander the moments that you have with the ones, and you try to make those moments matter. And by making those moments matter with one of them, you'll have an impression on them that will stay with them and will stay with them for a long period of time. Even today, I retired now, you know, 7 years ago, but if I show up in the Deloitte office in Australia, I'll have people come up and speak to me. Hmm. And say, Jim, I was in your class of 2007. I heard your lecture on culture and values in Cape Town, South Africa. And I've never forgotten what you've said. It still, even today, influences how I think and behave as a Deloitte partner.
Yeah.
And so I think it's that willingness to try to make those moments matter and try to make those connections. And sometimes you're with more than one. But many times you're with one, and with the one that you're with, they're going to tell others, and those stories will have a way to leverage through the firm in quite a surprising way.
Yeah. And I love that example because we often think of this, of the one as it being needing to be a one-on-one relationship. But oftentimes you can be teaching in a classroom, but that individual still feels like the one because you're sort of speaking to them, right? And they can connect
with
you.
I think, frankly, even in general conference, you can watch one of the brethren speak. And you can feel President Nelson speaking to me, and he knows what I'm feeling, and he knows what I'm challenged by with what he now is encouraging. And there might be 16 million people who think they had that one-on-one connection and that one-on-one experience.
Yeah. And so, you know, you mentioned as far as like during your time as a CEO, like were you intentionally having rituals and habits that were helping you connect with the ones in your organization? Or how did you go about doing that? Was it an intentional thing, or is it something that just naturally came to you?
I just simply, the person in front of me was my number one priority. Mm. The person on the phone was the number one priority. And, you know, perhaps to a fault, the email that just arrived was not my top priority.
Right.
And so when my BlackBerry buzzed, I did not interrupt a meeting that I was leading. And I just simply counted on if something urgent was happening that required my immediate attention, my secretary was going to come extract me from that room. Mm. And I didn't try to multitask by watching my BlackBerry or my iPhone as that evolved over time. I just simply connected with those that were on my calendar and that I was just simply moving from conference room to conference room, meeting to meeting, but trying to stay in the moment with the people that I had committed to spend time with.
Yeah. And I would imagine, I mean, I can't even begin to imagine what it's like running such a large organization with so many questions and thoughts and perspectives coming at you, but still feeling like you're getting something done rather than just putting out fires. So was it a matter of creating boundaries, or how did you go about that so that you could feel like you're actually accomplishing something, not just being overwhelmed by the information?
Well, first of all, if you're leading a very large organization, you don't want, you don't expect, and you hope they don't think they're all going to come to you asking for direction every day. And so in the same way that I think the prophet Joseph said, we teach them correct principles and they govern themselves. You establish the culture of the organization, and by establishing the culture of the organization and then the leaders in the organization buying into and demonstrating and believing in that culture, you know how they're going to behave as they lead our firm in. And then pick your favorite city, pick 650 cities around the world. I didn't want the office managing partner in those 650 cities calling me to ask for counsel or advice. But when I spoke at their partners meeting in their country, I was able to articulate what was important to us as an organization strategically and what I expected of them culturally and what I wanted them to be able to do. And by then trying to connect with them in that, you know, one-on-one setting, if you will, when I happened to be in country with them, I expected and believed that they were then going to behave themselves in a manner that was in accordance with our values and in accordance with our culture.
Yeah, well, that's fascinating. That's really helpful. And you mentioned culture and this person, you know, that ran into you and said, I remember that meeting, what you said about culture. Where do you even begin to establish a healthy culture in such a large organization?
You just simply tell them what you expect of them as they carry the Deloitte business card. And if that Deloitte business card said partner on it, then you tell them that one of our values is a commitment to each other. And then you use stories to try to drive that in a very impressionable way into their mind, and how they can demonstrate their commitment to each other, i.e. to their colleagues, when one of their colleagues is looking for some help and assistance on an engagement. Part of your commitment to each other then is supporting that individual with that client need at that moment. But just simply go through the values, and then you use stories to try to drive that home into people's minds, and hopefully into their hearts, and hopefully into how they think and how they behave and how they act. And that's what you try to do as a business leader. The culture part of the equation of leading a large organization cannot be overstated.
Yeah. So you mentioned stories. Is there a go-to story that comes to mind that you referenced a lot in order to embed this culture in your organization?
Nothing that really, you know, jumps to mind. I was someone who I would write takeaways. That's how we branded them. But my professionals were client service professionals, so they were in the field delivering a project, a consulting engagement, an advisory engagement, an audit engagement, a tax engagement. And so they were connecting with clients. And what I would do is I would write what I called takeaways based on my own client experiences. And what I was trying to do is connect with my client service professionals in a way that I could then influence their behavior. So, for example, a simple story. I sat down with the CEO of General Motors, Rick Wagner, and we were having dinner together because we were changing partners on the General Motors account. And Rick was there to say thank you to Larry Koch, who was rotating after 5 years serving General Motors. And then when I got back to my house in Connecticut, I sent a note to Rick and said, thank you very much for the time. I enjoyed your commitment to and spend time to recognize Larry Koch, and B, I just enjoyed our conversation that night. And oh, by the way, here's a picture of my wife, Bonnie, and me in front of our Chevy Avalanche. We like your products.
Nice.
And then Rick, so just think, if you're the CEO of General Motors, you're a pretty busy guy.
Yeah.
You have a really challenging job. He sent me back a handwritten note, and he said, Jim, thank you very much. I love seeing that you've got a 2005 Avalanche. You should be buying the 2006. We've made some significant improvements in that product. And then I sent a note to the partners just emphasizing that I had taken the time to send a handwritten note to Rick Wagner, the CEO of General Motors. And even though he's an enormously busy executive, he sent back a handwritten note to me. And then I challenged them in the takeaway to think about those connections that you have and how you can be more effective by getting out of the drumbeat of email and electronic communications and on occasion send a handwritten note because you'll make an impression. And I then sent that to, you know, all of my partners.
Like in a newsletter format, like email?
I just called them takeaways. And so they simply went as an email.
Okay, cool.
But it was less than 200 words almost always. And you could almost see the whole thing on your PDA, or you didn't have to scroll through multiple pages.
Yeah.
And then we were overt in no attachments, no picture of me, no, just super easy to get on your PDA.
Yeah.
Super easy to read. And we were just simply trying to send a clear message of client connections and how you can strengthen your relationships with some of those very personal moments of handwritten notes.
Yeah.
In that simple example.
No, I love that it's short and then it's a simple, powerful message. And it's not like, oh, okay, another email from, you know, Jim Quigley. I got to sit down and maybe I'll, you know, spend a few hours reading. They knew that
there's no PowerPoint deck attached.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's no picture of me attached. Uh-huh. There's not any attachment. There's just simply,
powerful.
Here's the words of my experience and my connection with Rick Wagner, the CEO of General Motors. Mm-hmm.
And through those takeaways, that sort of, again and again, as you share those, it establishes a culture of, this is an example of how we do things and the result that come from it and why we do it, right?
So you're reinforcing culture again, mm-hmm. is the point.
Yeah. And I would imagine, I mean, in any organization, there's going to be a percentage where I would imagine, you know, in Deloitte thinking, you know, there's individuals who say, listen, I went to college, I got a job here, you know, I'm here for the job, I need to pay the bills, and, you know, your cute slogans and takeaways, whatever, like, how do you get the buy-in? And obviously, there's some people that hopefully just sort of filter out of an organization that wants to establish culture, but is there a way to get buy-in other than maybe just the consistent takeaways that you did?
Well, obviously, in a large organization, and at Deloitte, we hire over 40,000 people a year. Mm-hmm. So there's a large number of people coming, and we also have turnover in the teens. And so there are people who are departing, who decide professional services is not my cup of tea, or it's not something that they do or that they do well. But we work hard to try to get people to think in the direction of they have something more than a J-O-B, mm-hmm. that they want to have a career. And when you can get them to stop thinking about, I have a J-O-B at Deloitte, and you start having them think, I have a career in professional services, and I like what I do. I like the people I do it with. I like the challenges that are coming my direction. Now you're going to get something more than the contractual commitment from those individuals. You're going to get their discretionary effort. You're going to start to get their very best. And when you start to get the very best, now you have the winning edge and you're going to be able to outperform those with whom you compete. Mm.
That's great. And what I learned from that is that you almost just call it out. Like if you are here for a J-O-B, like we want to challenge that and invite you to find more deeper purpose in our organization, because that's where you'll really enjoy working here, right?
Well, when you transition from having a job to being committed to a career, mm-hmm. that's transformative in how an individual thinks and how they act.
Yeah, that's so powerful. And with 40,000 plus people that you're bringing on board every year, was there anything extra or specific you did with the onboarding process to infuse the culture in them as quickly as possible?
No, absolutely. We have built a world-class leadership development center in Dallas.
Wow.
Okay. At Deloitte University. And because of the success of that, we now have 5 other campuses around the world. And so as a new recruit at Deloitte, as part of our commitment to those professionals, they go to Deloitte University. And a element of the content that you're going to receive is not just what do I need to know, understand, and be able to do to technically function as a consultant, to technically function as an auditor, to technically function as a tax professional. You're also going to learn about the Deloitte culture and who we are as an organization and what we value and what we expect from each other.
Hmm, that's powerful. I like that. And so even if they weren't, if a Deloitte University wasn't close to them, they would fly out to wherever the closest one was, I would imagine, and go through that?
Well, Deloitte University in the U.S. happens to be in Dallas.
Okay.
And so, but we also do lots and lots of training, and much of that has a culture content, you know, across the country in our regional offices. But we also have a Deloitte University campus in Singapore. We have a Deloitte University campus in Brussels. We have a Deloitte University campus in France, et cetera, et cetera.
Wow. And that, this is a very intentional way of onboarding those individuals to become familiar with Deloitte as an organization and the culture. Right? That's awesome.
Absolutely.
So I want to pivot towards your time as a, being called as a bishop and serving as a bishop while you're the CEO of Deloitte. And if I read it right, was the, your stake president at the time, he worked for Deloitte, right?
He's one of my partners.
Oh, okay. So were you essentially his boss when he called
That's
you
correct.
As bishop? That's an interesting dynamic. What do you remember about that experience being called as a bishop?
I just remember when President Jones came to my home. And he said that he'd been, he knew what my responsibilities were. I was then the leader of Deloitte in New York, and he knew, you know, how many thousand people I had in the organization, and he knew how hard I was working. And he said he'd been arguing with the Lord for 3 weeks to try to convince him not to call me, but he ultimately surrendered and extended the call.
Yeah, because I would imagine, I mean, when your name comes up on the list, he's thinking, this man is busy enough, and he's being a leader. He's, his influence is being felt. Maybe that's not the best option, but obviously the spirit was insistent. And so how about from your perspective with that, here you are running a large organization. How did you make that shift or that balance or start creating that balance between not only being an effective CEO, but also being an effective bishop?
Well, you just simply accept President Hinckley's challenge and you do your very best.
Mm. Nice. And you
he didn't say to me that I should step away as a Deloitte partner to be the bishop.
Right.
But you call a leadership team that were very able. You know, Dave Checkitz was my young men's president. Hmm. Dave Neeleman was my ward mission leader. These men were very able.
Wow.
And there was a, you know, small subset of things that a bishop cannot delegate, and those things you do.
Mm-hmm.
The long list of things that a bishop can delegate, you delegate.
Yeah.
And you count on and rely on your people to do those and do those things well.
Yeah. Was there, I imagine, as you mentioned before you hit record, that you traveled quite a bit as CEO, which I think most CEOs do. How did that work into balancing all your, did you always make sure you're back on Sunday, or how did you balance all that?
Everything in my power to not be out of town on Sunday. Mm. And my people knew that I had this ecclesiastical leadership role. And so it would be very rare that I would have a business call on Sunday. And my partners respected that. They understood that.
Yeah. Was there aspects of being a bishop that you turned to some of those skills and abilities you learned in the professional world? You know, was there intention of establishing a healthy culture and somehow within your ward? Or, and what did that look like?
The culture part, I'm not sure that I think about that, but I did really focus on what is it that we want to accomplish. And then I took a very, you know, inclusive approach in developing those ward goals or that ward ambition and what our areas of focus should be, so that it was owned by the broader leadership team. And then everyone would then be committed to work towards trying to accomplish that. But one of the things that happens as an ecclesiastical leader, you end up conducting lots of meetings. Now, if you want to have an impact on that ward family and be of help to them, you better know how to run a meeting professionally and effectively and not squander people's time and have an agenda and be clear and focused and seek input and advice and then make decisions and just simply keep moving. But I think those skills, i.e. those leadership skills, like how to conduct an effective meeting, also help you be effective as a bishop.
Yeah. So speaking of meetings, are, I mean, regardless if it's in the church context or in the professional context, are there any hard and fast rules that that you lived and died by with as far as running a meeting?
One of my counselors told me that the spirit leaves when the allotted time has expired. And whether that's nice. Literally true or not, I don't know. But you try not to have your sacrament meetings run over time.
Yeah.
You try not to have your bishopric meetings run over time. You try not to have ward council run over time. And to do that, then you have to have an, you know, an effective cadence and a respectful cadence to get that done. But I tried to respect everyone's time in that manner. And then I also tried to take the coaching that I had from Kurt Schneiber that the spirit's going to leave when the appointed time has been spent. I can't remember. Maybe you can name an example. I can't remember an example where a session of General Conference lasted 2 hours and 15 minutes.
Yeah.
I can't come up with one example.
I can think of a few where it ended early and there's even better, right? So, as far as being intentional with the time frame, and I know a lot of bishoprics, some I've been in that, you know, we sort of just show up on a weeknight and meet, but there's not a lot of time. We'll leave when we're done. So were you intentional of saying, you know, this meeting is going to last an hour or anything like that?
Well, the meeting block that you work through on Sunday is rigorous because you do have your bishopric meeting, and that's a defined amount of time. Mm-hmm. You have your PEC meeting. That's a defined amount of time. And then you have your sacral meeting. That's a defined amount of time.
Yeah.
And if you want that to actually be happening in a disciplined and orderly way, then you have to observe and respect the time. And if when you have a meeting during the week, knowing that I was going to be on my way into the city at 6:30 a.m., we didn't let those run to, you know, 10:30, 11 o'clock at night.
Yeah. And you mentioned it, having an agenda. I think that's sage advice in general that I think people understand. But I mean, how did you go about organizing that agenda and using it in the meeting to actually move through the meeting?
Well, that's what you need and want and expect and ask your executive secretary to help you do.
Yeah. Nice. So you delegate a lot of that responsibility on the executive secretary to make sure that happens, right?
Great. I think bishops that try to do everything will discover that they're less effective than those who are actually willing to provide opportunities for everyone to serve and to grow.
Yeah. Pivoting a little bit back towards your time at Deloitte and then also as your time as bishop, in regards to I met your lovely wife, Bonnie, wonderful lady. And did you involve her in any way as your role as CEO, or maybe that wasn't necessary? I don't know.
Well, as a CEO, she was very much my partner and she had relationships that some of the ties that bind a global organization together are personal ties. If I got off the plane in Tokyo and Bonnie was not with me, the Japanese partners were disappointed. Mm. The Japanese partners' spouses were disappointed. And she was very thoughtful and very inclusive in terms of her attitude and approach. If we were in India, she was willing to wear the attire that the Indian women would wear. Mm. She was willing to have her hands henna painted and just to be inclusive and to be respectful of things that were important to others. And that simply made us a stronger leadership team, the fact that we were together. And she would accompany me on those global trips at least once per quarter, and sometimes maybe a little bit more, not every trip by any stretch.
Yeah. And then what about as a bishop, how did you look to her in her role as sort of that I call an unofficial calling as bishop's wife?
I think much of what flows to you as a bishop is confidential, and so you don't talk to anyone about it, including your wife.
Yeah.
But when it comes to supporting you at, you know, ward activities and being helpful, and then also, you know, fulfilling her own responsibilities, it's a brilliant and wonderful example that influences the tone of what happens in the ward.
Yeah, that's awesome. I had an opportunity to meet your son, Nate, who runs the company Chatbooks. We'll give them a great plug for a great company. And they have fantastic, hilarious commercials that I always love to watch on YouTube. And he's recently been called as a bishop. So I'm curious whether you reference that conversation with your son, or what would you say to a brand new bishop as far as just some general advice? Any other principles other than what you've mentioned come to mind?
I shared with him what my brother had said to me, and I can't reproduce this talk, and so I'm going to make it sound more authoritative than anyone might think it deserves. But I was given a talk that Boyd K. Packer gave one time in some leadership setting. It was not in a general conference kind of setting, but somebody was quoting him. And his advice was, "Bishop, do not have a stack of emotional support vouchers on your desk and then obligate the members of your ward to try to come to your office to pick up one of those emotional support vouchers every week." And I just simply took that in the spirit of how important self-reliance was, and how what my ambition was for my ward to be self-reliant. Mm-hmm. I wanted them self-reliant temporally. I wanted them self-reliant spiritually. And I didn't want them to feel that they wouldn't be able to make it through the coming week if they didn't have a chance to sit down with me and receive one of these emotional support vouchers. So I did say that to Nate as he stepped into his new role. And then I also encouraged him to just simply look at the handbook. There are some things you cannot delegate. And then helping to bring that whole notion of ministering at that level and helping to make the atonement real in the lives of the individual members of the ward, that's where you should be spending your time.
Yeah.
And everything else can be delegated. Delegate it.
Yeah. Now, you served as a bishop in Connecticut, right? In an area that, you know, you had a lot of individuals going to New York to work, I would imagine. It's good.
Many commuters.
Yeah, yes. Many commuters there. Were there any unique aspects of your ward that created some unique challenges that maybe wouldn't have been found in a traditional, you know, Utah ward? Or
I haven't been a bishop in a Utah ward. Right. So I think there's probably more similarities than there are differences. Mm. And that's one of the great benefits of the church, I find, is when I travel and I end up being away on a Sunday and I attend sacrament meeting in Mexico City, it looks like sacrament meeting in New Canaan, Connecticut. Mm. And when I attend sacrament meeting in Brussels, Belgium, it looks like sacrament meeting in Park City, Utah. Now, in fairness, there's more and different languages spoken. Yeah. And you look at the hymnals and they are in different languages. But the meetings themselves and the training that has been provided makes it very much a unified message. And so I think much more about how similar it is than how different it is.
Yeah. I'm curious, obviously you've transitioned, you had to go through transition from being released as bishop and from being a CEO. And I know in my experience, I've talked with other past bishops, you sort of, you know, you're in these callings for so long or in these professional jobs so long that you sort of, it attaches to your identity. You sort of feel like, you know, I am the bishop and now I'm not, you know, just overnight. How would you describe that transition away from some of these major, really busy roles that you've had in your life?
Well, you just have to not lose track of who you are and what's important to you. And don't get overly invested in that title, because when it's gone, you're still going to be here.
Yeah.
And so you have to be willing to believe. And what I said in Deloitte is, when I gave someone a leadership and management responsibility, I said, come with a sense of urgency and come to that assignment to make a difference. And know that you're not going to be in that assignment for the balance of your career, but come to it and make a difference. And then you're going to be returning to a client service role at some point in time. Keep your client service skills relevant and keep them sharp.
Yeah. And that's intriguing that as far as like, obviously you've had opportunity to promote or hire individuals to certain managerial positions. And was there anything else you said to, as far as enable them to really succeed? What encouragement in general would you give them on in that simple meeting to make sure they were on the right foot?
Well, I wanted them to really try to, and I always said to them, one of the most important qualifications for what I'm asking you is that you want to do this. So I would like you to lead our practice in Dallas. Do you want to do that? Are you willing to take that responsibility? And here's what we need to do and what I expect and want to try to accomplish in that marketplace. Are you ready to take that on? And are you willing to take that on? And do you have some ideas and commitment on how you would go about doing that?
Yeah.
And we would have a for real appointment kind of conversation in that kind of setting.
Yeah. Did anybody ever say, no, I don't want to do that?
Of course.
Yeah.
I had one partner in particular and he just said, Jim, I can't see myself in Texas. I am from Minnesota. I am from the northern Midwest. In Minnesota, everybody wants you to think you have less money than you have. In Texas, it looks to me like everyone behaves like they have more money than they have. And I don't think culturally I could fit in.
Yeah.
And that was just simply his,
right, sure.
His view. But and so he then chose not to take that assignment.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So anything else you would encourage them to do as you would, anything else comes to mind? If not, that's fine.
Just be a team player and become, everyone's going to look to you, especially when you're appointed to a leadership role. And so you have to be ready to demonstrate that you both A, understand, and then B, live the values of the firm. And that's my expectation of you.
Yeah, that's great. So so it's been 7 years since you officially left Deloitte. Is that what you said?
I did. I retired in 2012.
Nice. So what's your life consist of now?
I'm on the board of Wells Fargo.
Oh, wow.
I'm the chairman of the board of Hess. I'm on the board of Merrimack Pharmaceuticals. I'm on my son Nate's chapbooks board. And then I have a real passion for leadership in education. And I am working to bring incremental private sector resources to support our education leaders with leadership development. And so I take school principals, 250 at a time, sometimes 350, to Deloitte University for a leadership weekend. And we work Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, providing to them the same leadership development content that we provide to Deloitte partners.
Oh, wow. And these are just everyday principals from across the country?
The most important leaders in our country. They're not everyday.
Right.
These are the most important leaders in our country.
Yeah.
These education leaders are going to make a huge difference in the kind of communities we have and the kind of country we will one day be.
Yeah.
So I need the support and commitment of their superintendents who are going to then pay the cost of them going to Deloitte University. But I've had, of the 950 principals in the state of Utah, I've had 300 of them at Deloitte University.
Wow, that's fantastic. Where did this passion or idea come from?
Started with when Joel Klein was the Chancellor of Education for Mayor Bloomberg. He came to a group of business leaders in New York and he said to us that he'd done what we would expect him to do. He'd looked at classroom achievement in New York City's 1,500 public schools, and then he looked at the top quintile and then did a root cause analysis to try to understand what makes these 300 schools so different than these other 1,200 schools in classroom achievement. And what he said to us as a group of business leaders, almost perfect correlation to strong leader in the building. And then to us, he said, will you help me get more strong leaders in our school buildings in New York City? And so I am working to bring incremental private sector resources to support leadership development for our school leaders.
Nice. Wow, that's fantastic. That really resonates with me as I'm passionate about leadership and especially I've seen how simple skills and abilities have enabled everyday people that become great, influential leaders. So if there's somebody listening that maybe a principal or knows a principal or wants to be involved in something like that, is there an organization to look towards or even contribute in some way?
They need to just work with their superintendent. And if they want to participate in Deloitte's Courageous Principals program, that's the title of the program, Courageous Principals, then they can contact the leader of that, Lauren Pazinski, who is the manager who runs our Courageous Principals program and does the recruiting. And also, frankly, the screening, because we have the program is, almost to the point where we're oversold and waiting list. That's a modest exaggeration. But the key is a superintendent who is really committed to leadership development. And if that superintendent is committed to leadership development, and we become a resource that can help that individual perform what I think is one of their most important responsibilities. The development of the principals under their charge and the building of a leadership pipeline of aspiring principals prepared to take on a principalship.
Nice. Wow, that's fascinating. As you consider your time as CEO of Deloitte and also as your time serving in church leadership and as a father, how has being a leader made you a better disciple or follower of Jesus Christ?
I think what you look to is who is the ultimate leader. And I really do think there was an interesting book, the title I'm not going to be able to produce, but it was just simply talking about Christ as a leader. And what I think that does is it helps you really personalize what would the Savior do? And what it then does, for me at least, is it helps me with those one-on-one interactions. If I'm unhappy with something, you can still do that correction that's needed, but you can do it in a very professional and dignified way. It doesn't have to be a bloodletting experience on the boardroom table where you try to provide someone a public personnel evaluation. That's not what I did. That's not how I behaved.
That concludes my interview with Jim Quigley. Such a fun conversation to learn from somebody so experienced in such unique circumstances with running such a large organization. And how do you lead there? I would get so overwhelmed with some of those challenges, but I appreciate the principles that Jim talked through and discussed, and I hope you benefited as well. This is one you may want to listen to it one or two times just to make sure you don't miss any of those gems that he talked about. And hopefully we can continue to engage with some of these accomplished business leaders and talk about the principles that they established in their career and how they've been able to leverage those principles in their service in the church as well and leadership in life. So if you know of anybody else I should interview, feel free to reach out to me. Go to leadingsaints.org/contact, and there you can send me a quick message. I have something to consider, and we'll see if we can line it up. And of course, I remind you, go to leadingsaints.org/tour to grab one of those remaining seats of the church history tour that's happening in September. And remember, text the word LEAD to 474747, and we'll send you more information about the Questioning Saints Virtual Summit.
It came as a result of the position of leadership which was imposed upon us by the God of heaven, who brought forth a restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And when the declaration was made concerning the only true and living church upon the face of the earth, we were immediately put in a position of loneliness. The loneliness of leadership, from which we cannot shrink nor run away, and to which we must face up with boldness and courage and ability.